What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Listening to Rock and or Roll, I'm BJ, and we're continuing the Power Pop series. We're going to hear from three different guys today from three different bands, beginning with Scott Krueger, who was in a band from Milwaukee called The Shivers, with two V's, most famous for their single Teen Line. Then we're going to hear from John McMullen, who was in a band out of Missouri called The Trend, who released a single and an LP, both of which are very rare. And finally, we're going to hear from Vance Brescia, who was in the band The Mosquitoes from New York, most famous for their song That Was Then, This Is Now, that was covered by the Monkees. For my podcast, I'm putting together kind of a series of episodes about power pop, and
okay,
so it seems like you kind of, I wonder where punk fits in, like the Orbits. The Orbits, I love that song, Make the Rules. That's, and I think of that as a power pop song.
Yeah.
But were you guys, did you think of yourselves as a punk band or?
Yeah, that's a good question. I always talked to Jill about that too. We never considered ourselves power pop or punk. I mean, I was a big Who fan.
Yeah.
You know, and just like powerful music with melody. I mean, that's why I looked at it. But, you know, I mean, the bands we listened to back then, I guess, were the Who, Badfinger. As far as inspiration, and, you know, I listened to the Stones a lot. They were big. The Stooges were a big inspiration. Flaming Groovies were a big inspiration. Mott the Hoople. I mean, things like that. But as far as, like, I don't think we ever, like, in the Shivers, the power pop ever came up. We never thought of ourselves as a punk band or power pop band. We just wanted to write our own powerful, melodic music. I mean, that was basically it. And as far as, like, putting it, I think power pop is a very limiting term. I mean, I never thought of it, but now I can see it now, but back then, no. As far as like the difference between punk and power pop, I think punk was just kind of an attitude, and you could even have that attitude in the Shivers. I always thought it was a punk attitude, but it was this melodic music and things like, you know, and like that. But as far as like pegging it ourselves, we never did that. No.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Like you said, Badfinger. It seems like Badfinger. I love Badfinger. They're so great, but you know, they never really. It seems like they're one of those groups that were a band's band. Like everybody else who was in bands loved Badfinger, and they were, you know, huge influence.
Yeah, you could say the same thing. Maybe say this. Yeah, you could say the same thing about Big Star.
Yeah.
I guess because we love Big Star too. I mean, I wore those albums out listening to Big Star and Badfinger, and they did. They did influence. I'm sure they influenced a lot of people to be in bands.
So you had Big Star, because that's another thing I've been trying to figure out is when people started discovering Big Star.
I'd have to say, in my case, Howie probably turned me on to Big Star. And Jerry Brisch turned me on to Big Star, and that would have been about 74, 75.
Really? Wow.
We used to get, yeah, because we got, those albums were cut out back then. You could find them in the cutout bins.
Yeah.
And I remember being with, there was a record store here called Dirty Jack's, and I can remember me and Jerry, and I'm talking about Presley Haskell, but he's Jerry to me, and Rick Nielsen. And I remember Rick Nielsen in the cutout bin picking up that first Big Star album and then asking us, was this any good? And we're saying, yeah, you got to buy it. It's fantastic.
Really?
But
where was that?
Yeah. And where or when?
Both, I guess.
Oh, okay. That would have been a place called Dirty Jack's Record Rack in Milwaukee. That would have been around, oh, God. I don't know, 75 maybe?
That's great. So you specifically remember that, Rick pulling that record out and saying, is this any good?
Yeah, and asking Jerry, not me. He asked Jerry, goes, well, yeah. is this any good? And then Jerry said, "This, you know, it's fantastic." And then they ended up covering a song on there in the street, I think.
Yeah, they did that for that 70s show. Yeah, I've heard that before,
right.
That the cut-opens would be full of those Big Star records. Those are worth hundreds of dollars now, and it's funny. I've heard other people say that you would go to the record store, they'd have a whole bunch of those Big Star records in the cut-out bin. That's crazy.
I still have mine.
Yeah.
I still have my Radio City, which I had Alex Chilton sign for me.
Wow.
And then the first record, because he used to see Alex Chilton a lot. I mean, you know, back in the 90s and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was like before they had the Big Star reunion, but I remember seeing him at, was it Shank Hall then? I think it was Shank Hall. And he did, he was doing September Girls, and then he broke a string, and then the intro September Girls, he broke a string, and he said, that's enough of that. And then he didn't even play the song anymore. He you know, went on to the next thing. And then I remember playing, Jill and I went, we were in the Shivers, and this was, must have been like 81, 82. We were playing in Chicago, and we were finished, And I don't know where it was, but Alex Chilton was playing like across the street somewhere. So, oh, let's go see Alex Chilton. That'd be fantastic. So we went up there. There was nobody up there. He had a bottle of Jack Daniels in his hand, and he was like holding the microphone and just like kind of like just swaying around. And he was really drunk, and he was very disappointed. We were very sad, and we left because it was just too sad to see him like that. But I think he got better a little bit later when he put the, you know, he had the Big Star thing. But those albums, those two albums are like the greatest, in my opinion. Those are the greatest albums ever. Those Big Star. I mean, I still listen to them. I mean, they're just fantastic. As far as the Shivers goes, we were stuck in the wrong place, and you know, we should have got out of here, because there was a time when you know, we were just kind of, you're kind of like just treading water. I mean, basically, I mean, you know, there's only so much you can do here, and you know, you can play the clubs and you can do that again. And Adam and he didn't seem to think that we were ready to do anything yet, and Jill and I thought we were. And then some guys in the band, they did actually, Jimmy and Mike, they moved to Boston. And to me and Jill, was like, what's the point of moving to Boston? Because we had Greg Shaw express interest in us mm-hmm. and putting us on Bomb. Mm-hmm. And I said, let's just go to California. We should go to California. But by that time, it was too late, and the band kind of disintegrated. So we just ended up not doing anything. But I always thought we were told, you know, we don't have the songs. I'm going, what do you mean we don't have the songs? I said, we have great songs. But it was just a matter of, you know, the time. And you know, you need one person really to go to bat for you, and that, you know, that person never came along for us. But if I, in hindsight, you know, if it was up to me, we would have moved out to California. So I think something would have happened to us then. You know, we just forgot about the songs, and then we forgot about, you know, whatever. And then I remember, I don't know where I saw it or where I heard it, but I saw something on, maybe it was on the internet, about a band called The Shivers, a great band. And I remember telling Jill, I go, there's another band called The Shivers, and they're getting all this attention, but it was us. this guy in Massachusetts, like, put out our stuff, and I go, he eventually told us, he goes, well, I bootlegged you guys and stuff, and that's, he kind of started the whole thing rolling. But anyway, he, you know, and then all of a sudden, and then we started getting all this attention and stuff, and then it's great.
Yeah, you guys would have been a great fit with Bomb, for sure.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, if we could have went, and Greg Shaw said, you know, I'm interested in working with you guys. And that might have even been before I was in the band. Because they put out Teen Line before I was in the band. But I don't know why they never advised. Well, it's a hard thing to do, to drop everything and just to move somewhere, I guess. But, you know, that would have been our best opportunity to achieve more than we did, I guess, you know. But I'm happy that people recognize us now and, you know, like the stuff now. And I always told Jill, well, hey, if we didn't have the songs, I mean, that's not true, because that's what now, I mean, that's what, you know, people, we did have the songs and stuff. And Sing Sing reissued our stuff, and then a Rerun reissued our stuff. And Jill and I were able to take the master tapes that we did have for that. Some of the stuff, some of that stuff. Do you have their album or the CD or the record?
Yeah, I have a CD, yeah.
Yeah, and but we were able to remix a lot of that stuff, and then some of the stuff we had to take off cassette, and, you know. But there's a guy named Justin Perkins that mastered that stuff. They did a great job with it. So, but, you know, there are, you know, there's always things you can think of, you know, in moving out to Los Angeles, easier said than done. Now it's easy to say that, but who knows what would have happened if we did. But that would have been the thing to do.
Didn't I read that you almost had a record deal with Arista or something like that?
We sent our stuff to Arista, but they just said they weren't interested.
Oh.
And then Eric Carmen did tell Jill, he said, you know, he goes, I'm not going to help you guys get a deal, but if you guys get a record deal, I'll produce your record. But we only sent our stuff out to maybe one or two labels, Arista being one. And, you know, we didn't get a very good, but, you know, you got to send it out. You got to do a lot of work to do that stuff. You can't send it out to two labels and expect something to happen. So, but we really didn't have people. I mean, back then, you know, if you were in a band, you had people, I know, I can't explain it, but you didn't do the legwork yourself. I guess we didn't think we could or something. So, you'd put that into someone else would do that, but it seemed like people weren't really willing to work for us that hard. But I wish it would have been great. It would have been great to have Eric Carmen produce it.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. You know? I can't think of anything. Did he ever even get into production?
He'd produce some girl. He, after the band broke up, he wanted to do this stuff with Jill, but Jill, she wasn't interested in it. He wanted to have someone do, like, a female do Raspberry songs and stuff, and he had the band put to Peterson was going to be Tom Peterson was going to play bass, and I don't know what else, but Jill, you know, she didn't want to do it. But that was after the Shivers and stuff. So he did produce somebody, and she knows I don't know who this person is, but I don't think it really went anywhere. Mm-hmm. She might have done a cover of Go All the Way or something, this woman or girl, I don't know who it was, she would know, but it didn't go anywhere.
How did Eric Carmen know about you? Did you open for him or something?
There was a thing in California. There was a Raspberries Eric Carmen fanzine called the Carmen Connection. And there was a woman there that interviewed us back then. I think she got word to Eric Carmen about us. And then he eventually called us, or called Jill. I actually think it was more interested in Jill as far as like a solo thing than anything mm-hmm. else. And offered to produce us if we had a label. But that's how he hooked up with us, is for this place in Los Angeles, some fanzine called the Carmen Connection.
Well, so I mean, obviously, you know, there's kind of a power pop cult, and I've been into it since the 90s, you know, and and you know, I have like a 10-volume series of CDs that are called Teen Line. I don't know if you've seen those. but they're just compilations.
That's the guy in Boston. Yeah, that's the guy in Boston.
Yeah. And they're just compilations of like random weird songs from singles and all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
Right. Wait, what's that guy's name? Damn it. I haven't talked to him in a while. But yeah, that's who put it out, is the guy in Boston that put out the Shiver stuff too.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And so that song is just, at this point, you know, it's to a niche audience or whatever, but it's like a legendary song. You know what I mean? I mean,
but Teen Line is a legendary song?
Yeah, yeah. In terms of like the niche power pop community or whatever, the people that are into that stuff.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, everybody.
I remember reading somewhere, it's Jill's song, it's not mine, so I'm not blowing my horn. I have nothing to do with it. I didn't record it, but they called it one of the greatest independent power pop songs of all time. They call it Teen Line.
Right.
Because it wasn't, we didn't have a label or anything. We just put it out. But it sounds great. I mean, I remember recording, you know, the stuff later with the Shivers, and you know, we went to good studios. We saved up our money, and we played out so much that I think we just did two or three takes of these songs, and probably no overdubs or not many overdubs, and just put them out like that. But yeah, Teen Line, that's a, you know, and I see this. There's bands in Japan that did our song. There were two bands, or maybe more, but that cover that song too. So that's a, I always tell Jill, I mean, that's a great compliment to you and your songwriting, is that, you know, bands actually covered that song and stuff. And so it's cool. And there was a place in, was it Barcelona or Madrid? They had like a Shivers party there and stuff. I'm going, what? But that's cool too. So yeah, it's just, we got a lot of notoriety.
Yeah.
Over the years. So that's great. I'm very pleased with that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's kind of like the story of Big Star, where, you know, they got rediscovered. People didn't really know about them in their time.
Oh, yeah.
They got rediscovered later. And the Shivers is just kind of a smaller version of that, where, you know.
Right. So yeah, if we would have had a couple albums out, that would have made all the difference in the world. But, you know, whatever. At least we got that one album out. So that, you know, it's very cool, and I mean, getting recognition is an amazing thing that it would, you know, last this long. But you know, we're very grateful for it.
Yeah. Well, God, the records are worth, the value of vinyl has skyrocketed in like the last 5 years. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's huge now.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and I mean, we got Jill, I think. She got like $300 or $400 for those singles, a couple of them.
Yeah, definitely worth a lot of money. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I have one, but I can't sell it. It's mine.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
I want to keep it. It's mine. You know, it means a lot to us. So then we can, you know. And I remember when Jill's mom passed away a few years ago, and her dad passed away prior to that. But anyway, she was selling the house for her mom. We were cleaning it out. And we go in this little, like, well, what's this? It's like a little, not a closet, but a little something. I don't know why. I don't remember. I remember finding, like, 4 Shiver singles in there. I think her dad saved them.
Oh, wow.
I go, Joe, look, we got 4 Shiver singles and stuff. So that was pretty cool. So he said thanks to her dad, but that was kind of neat.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and the reissues are great, and it's great having the stuff, and it's great, you know, people still remember us. But those were great. Those are good songs. I mean, we gave up. We didn't even think about it till there was kind of a resurgence and stuff, and it's fantastic. I'm glad people like it. I'm glad people listen to it, and I think the songs on there speak for themselves.
Yeah, definitely.
My lucky day.
I would love to hear the story of the trend, like of how the band formed. And, you know, I've talked, because it's interesting. I talked to Will Birch. He doesn't really like the term power pop. And I talked to other guys. But it seems like the trend, we're like all in on power pop. That's the impression
I
get.
We absolutely were. What I don't like about the term power pop now is that there has been such a self-imposed exclusion. It's kind of become what the old album rockers predicted would happen, but it's done that because the people involved in it have done it to themselves. And I say that being someone who has absolutely been all in from the moment that that I heard it. I went nuts over power pop, literally, upon hearing. I mean, I was already loving bands like Sweet. I'd gone back, and this would have been about the time Sweet came out with Love Is Like Oxygen, and I bought the album Level Headed that had that on it, and I was like, I really like this rock that is catchy. And that's, you know, and I loved Cherry Baby by the band Stars. And then one night I was listening very late at night and heard Listen to Her Heart by Tom Petty for the first time. And so these were all things that I heard before the Knack and before the Romantics and before 2020. You know, the onslaught was right after this. But, you know, when I heard Listen to Her Heart by Tom Petty, I thought it was a Byrds reunion. I literally thought it was McGuinn, Clark, and Hillman, because I'd read about McGuinn, Clark, and Hillman getting back together. And I had some old Byrds records, and I was a huge Monkees fan and a Beatle fan. So, I mean, I loved all the original 60s bands. And then I heard Listen to Her Heart, and I'm like, oh, that's the Byrds, because I didn't know who Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers happened to be at the time. Then I learned who Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were, based on Breakdown being on the FM soundtrack. So, I mean, I loved all the FM rock too. I mean, even though I'm a power popster and claim it and put my hand up and all that sort of stuff, when power pop first came out, I was still buying Boston Records and Foreigner and all of that. And what I loved about power pop is how fresh it sounded, mixed right in with all that stuff. So I was starting to write some songs that were kind of simple, but my goal was, I've been taking classical piano since I was 5 years old from my mother, who was in her younger days somewhat of a concert pianist and a very, very amazingly gifted sight reader and classical pianist. And I took piano lessons from my mom, had a very solid classical background. I can score music, I can staff it out, I can do all that, and could do it at a relatively young age. But when I heard the simplicity of, like, you know, Listen to Her Heart by Tom Petty, and then right after that I heard the Ramones, and, you know, and so, you know, punk to me was, the punk I liked was the pop punk, like the Ramones. I didn't like the I never got into the Clash the way I got into the Ramones, for example, just because, you know, the Ramones sounded like a 60s girl group with distorted guitars and a male vocalist. It was all structured the way that something on Redbird Records would have been. And I loved it. And so when I first started writing songs, the idea was to find the catchiest thing with the simplest structure. And I understood structure because of classical music, and so it became like a puzzle to try to put catchy choruses together. And so this would have been in about the early part of 1978 when I really started writing some things. And I would have been 14, getting ready to be 15 years old. The very first song that I ever wrote that we ever recorded was a song called I Need Another Fix, or just Another Fix is how I wrote it, as Another Fix. And I wrote it to be faster than Buddy Holly, the same kind of chords as Buddy Holly. And at the same time, you know, I wanted it to be incredibly short, like the Ramones, you know. Mm-hmm. If it's less than 2 minutes, then great. You know, kind of one of those deals. And it turned out to be an okay song. And so this was all, you know, before I heard The Knack. And I'd been invited to play with a few different groups with a guy named Dennis Fuller and his brother Kevin. When I was a freshman in high school, I would have, at that point, been 13 going on 14. And then we, I guess, we played Sweet Home Alabama and Try and Love Again by the Eagles in a talent show. But Dennis and I got along real well. We were in the same grade, and he was a bass player. Then I went completely berserk. I'm going to skip ahead to, like, in the late spring of 79, I walked into a record store in Jonesboro, Arkansas. And I was, it took me a long time to figure out. I went in the record store for the sole purpose of finding the album You're Gonna Get It by Tom Petty, because it had Listen to Her Heart on it. And I'd been searching for it for quite a long time. And I finally figured out who it was. I finally realized it wasn't the Byrds or Gwen Clark and Hillman. I went in to get that album, and a brand new, and it must have been June of 79, probably. It seemed like it was spring, but it probably was about June of 79. I walk into this record store, and the moment I walk in, somebody that's behind the counter has the demonstration record going, and I hear Let Me Out by The Knack. And it blew me away. It absolutely, I heard that, and I'm like, oh my God, this, whoever is doing this is doing exactly what I want to do. And they've beat me to it. And so I'm a little bit ticked off, but I'm enthralled by it. And I stood there. I went into a record store to get a song that I thought I loved more than anything else in the world. And then the moment I walked in, I stood there and listened to all of side one of Get the Knack. And I was like, I got to have that no matter what it is. And I didn't have enough money to buy two things. So instead of buying Petty that day, I got, and all they had was a cassette. They, you know, they didn't even have vinyl available. They said they'd already sold it out. I didn't know. I was like, I don't know anything about these guys. And they were like, man, they're hot. They're going to be, you know, bigger than the Beatles, or as big as the Beatles, or the, what the people said. And I'm like, well, they sound kind of like them. And they also sound a little bit like the Monkees, and a little bit like Sweet, and just everything that is mixed together like that. I love it. And so I bought that the first day that it was available, at least in Jonesboro, Arkansas. I'm from Kennett, Missouri, by the way. And Jonesboro, Arkansas is about an hour away from Kennett, and it's where my grandparents lived. And so I went there all the time. My main record stores in high school were there. And I went nuts when I heard Get the Knack. Just went berserk.
Right.
And loved it. I still think it's, in terms of my, I mean, later I heard the first 2020 album and kind of ranked it ahead of Get the Knack. And when I heard the first Beat album, just the Beat, I put it ahead of Get the Knack. But for the time to be a band, I mean, that made me want to be, that made me want to get serious about forming a band, that I wasn't just, you know, playing pickup because somebody asked me to. I was like, I want to form the band. I want to use the songs I'm working on. And then the guys that were interested in that band with me were the guys that formed the Trend. I mean, Dennis Fuller, who I played in kind of a pickup band with, played bass. And then my really good friends, Brian Mitchell, who was a drummer and who also loved The Knack. And then on lead vocals, was Matt Collier. He could scream all night and never lose his voice. And when Matt and I sang together, we could sing in really good harmony. So, I mean, it was just a natural. We were the guys that liked the Knack. We performed in the same talent show called the Mod Assembly. We performed My Sharona, which, by the, I'll just tell you, I thought My Sharona was about next to the last as far as best songs on that album. It happened to be the one that caught on with, you know, top 40 radio. But, you know, every song on side one, to me, is better than My Sharona. But My Sharona was also good. And I do like the song.
I completely agree. I agree. It doesn't even sound like the rest of the album. And, yeah, I would rank it probably
like
the worst.
Sweet.
Yeah.
I thought Siamese Twins was worse, simply based on what everything else was providing. But still, I love Siamese Twins. Even it's a song that doesn't hang with the rest of the album, in my opinion either. But I still kind of thought Sharona was better than it. But we played that song in a talent show called the Mod Assembly, and people gave us a great response. We played Good Girls Don't as an encore, and we'd only practiced that one, I think, like twice. But it came off, and we had a pretty good feel, but we were definitely more garage than slick power pop at that moment. We were definitely, were not anything close to, you know, what I had generally been performing since a young age, and that we were anything but classical at that moment. I mean, you know, since then I've tried to integrate some things, but that's been long after the band was not a thing. But I loved every second of playing with the high school version of the Trend. We were four guys that just loved the Knack, and then it was like a new discovery every couple of weeks for the fall of 79 through all of 80, and then even at the very early part of 81. I mean, we were discovering it all together. I mean, the first 2020 album, the Plimsolls, first album on Planet, Phil Seymour, you know, I mean, the records. You know, we were trading albums back and forth. Listen to this. What do you think about that? You know, and so I mean, it was the four of us. You know, and then there were other. We had other friends who would talk to us about it some, but they didn't get into it. At that point, it was kind of new wave too. You know, because you know, new wave got lumped into everything, but there was definitely the power pop arm of new wave, and at that moment there could not have been anybody more all in than me as the guy who was trying to write the songs and, you know, wanting to perform originals that were as catchy as the others, and then at the same time the guys who were so willing to, you know, say, yeah, let's work on an original song. Yeah, this does sound a little bit like the Plimsolls. Yes, this one sounds like the Ramones, or this one, you know, they were, I mean, I couldn't have done it by myself. And the other guys were so amazingly all in on the direction. That was cool. That's how we got together. It was, we were the fans of the Knack at our school. Right. The big fans of the Knack. We were the ones who went to see them live. I ran away from home to go see the Knack. I got in so much trouble. I didn't have permission to see them in Memphis on a school night, and I went anyway, and I paid the price. I got all my musical equipment taken away from me for, you know, kind of, you know, being a bad boy. I was. I deserved it, but I had to see them. I had to see what they did on stage, and it was like education to me. And, it didn't match, you know, where, you know, we were all pretty good guys at school. We all, you know, we all made really good grades. We were, you know, it didn't necessarily fit. But at the same time, it was that bug hit us all hard. It hit me the hardest.
Yeah, I could. That was kind of my guess because of that. Your stuff came out in 81, and the look of the band, the sound of the band, it seemed like you guys were fans of power pop who wanted to do it too. You know, that was kind of my guess.
And we were. Now, I also felt a little bit slighted on it because I really was already doing it before I heard the Knack. I was so young, I didn't have a vehicle for it. And so, unfortunately, there's nothing tangible, you know, other than a few photographs from before our single. But there was definitely a fanhood that went with us. And we were, you know, there wasn't an easy way for people in Kennett, Missouri to track down information on some of these other bands. I mean, we had some decent radio. We had a station that was the album rock station out of Memphis, Rock 103, who had some DJs who were very sympathetic to New Wave and some power pop. I mean, they played Bram Tchaikovsky's Girl of My Dreams on the same channel that you were going to hear, you know, all the Led Zeppelin album tracks. That's where I heard it for the first time. You know, in terms of Joe Jackson, they played Is She Really Going Out With Him? Which, after it actually caught on, was in the top 40. Then even a couple of AM stations around here, you know, played it once it actually charted. But I mean, in terms of trying to keep up with it as it was going on, it was difficult. And we were buying magazines, and when one of us went someplace, we always hit a record shop trying to find the most interesting underground looking record we could find. And then, you know, everybody passed it around. And that's how I heard of the band The Colors. They were playing in New York. My family took a trip. I picked up this, you know, 5-track EP, and I'm like, gosh, this band is really, really cool. And then, you know, many years later, we're on the same compilation as The Colors. And I remember even looking at the way people looked in advertisements in Billboard or Record World and just guessing that they're going to have that kind of sound. And there was a record store in Memphis called Poplar Tunes that had every record that was put out was a demonstration record. And then you could go and literally have a little booth where you could play the record. And that's where I heard Shoes for the first time, was in one of those little demonstration booths at Poplar Tunes in Memphis, just because of the way the advertising looked, it made me think they're going to have the sound I want to hear. And they did. Yeah. It was amazing how things were back then, the way it was discovered. Now you don't have to do that. You don't have to put in the effort. There's instantaneous, you know, clicking back and forth and YouTube or whatever. And you can go down whatever hole you want to go down very quickly. But then, man, it took a lot of effort, and we loved the chase. And when you had a discovery that was worth passing along to your friends, that was an amazing thing.
Right. Yeah. I can still remember that to a certain extent, you know, right before I started collecting records, probably. Well, I mean, I was collecting music since I was a kid, but yeah, when I really started collecting records in the early mid 90s, you know, that was still before the internet. So I did a lot of buying records just because of what it looked like to see what it was going to sound like, you know. So
I know exactly anything that happened, you know, right before, everything became instantaneously available. You know, the effort meant that dictated a great deal. I mean, if you put the effort in, then you were going to ultimately find what you were looking for, but you had some guesses and you had some incorrect guesses, you know.
Yeah.
I remember some bands that I was, you know, disappointed in. we had other friends that were friends of our band that weren't as involved with us musically, but they did know music. They knew what they liked, and they would tip us off as well. You know, if they came across something, and a fellow that was a year older than I am, who I was on the same swim team with and all of that, he was a year older, and he went to Mizzou before I did by a year, and he's the one that heard the first Fool's Face album. And so he literally made me a tape and sent it to me and said, "You have to listen to this song right now. Drop what you're doing." And the song was "I Don't Want to Hear It" by Fool's Face, which I just love. I love that song. It's always been, you know, one of my favorites. And he made me, he described the band, told me it was a 5-man band. It was one of those bands that did have a keyboard player. He said, he told me all about them. I heard the song "I Don't Want to Hear It," and I just went nuts. I was like, "This is fantastic."
Pantheon podcast listeners, Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with 2 devices at once, new quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
I was a fan of Fool's Face long before we played with them. Not that long, but I mean, it definitely, I was familiar with their material because we had been tipped off. And Kennett's, you know, the town I'm from is a pretty musical town. And, you know, the guy that tipped me off, he was in the class ahead of me at school, in high school. And he took piano lessons from my mom as well. And Cheryl Crow took piano lessons from my mother as well. And Cheryl was, always into music, but she wasn't really into the new wave stuff. I mean, she loved the Eagles and she loved Fleetwood Mac. And ultimately, you know, literally played with them. or some of them. And it, you know, and but she always was incredibly supportive of us. I mean, she thought what we were doing was kind of odd and cute. But I remember, you know, she would periodically try to give us advice, like, well, you know, you might want to go a little bit, you know, spread out a little bit more than just new wave and just power pop. You know, it would probably help you, you know, if you were a little more broad minded, and she was ultimately right about that. But at the same time, we loved what I loved what I loved at the time. And there wasn't any way that we were going to kind of get too far away from something that was, you know, melodic and had that indie spirit thing. Before they even used the word indie. But it was an indie spirit that was kind of down underneath all of that with a lot of these bands. And some of them lost it when they got signed to major labels. Some of them miraculously, like, you know, 2020 sounded one way in when they were, I guess, recording with Bob, which was great. And then when they got signed to a major, Portrait, distributed by CBS, they even sounded better. And then it didn't quite work that way, or I didn't think it worked that way. But I think back of that time, on all that time, and it's just, it's my favorite period of music, obviously. And I love it and I miss it. And we sure worked really hard.
Yeah. You mentioned, indie rock, cause that's what Lucky Day really sounds like. Like Lucky Day could have come out in the '90s on an indie rock label.
I hear that all the time.
Yeah.
I hear that. And Lucky Day had a certain feel to it. We had a 3-hour session. I mean, we pulled our money, and all we could afford was 3 hours at Kennett Sound Studio, a local recording studio that had an 8-channel reel-to-reel multi-track recorder in it. And so we recorded it in the summer of 1981, and we of our allotted 3 hours, we spent almost all of our time on Lucky Day. And we had rehearsed it before going in, and both Matt Collier and I had kind of gotten our voices rough accidentally through our rehearsal from going in. And so we kept having to, so we did the instrumental track relatively quickly, and then we hand clapped over the top of it. And then we worked on the vocals a little while, which ultimately sound very, very rough, but kind of cool in an indie way, you know, much, much later, as it would have sounded. And then we had very little time left for the flip side. And, so we just kind of we did She's Hi-Fi, the main track, and we did it in one take. We did and I did an overdub of the rhythm guitar part because I wanted it to sound a little bit like the B-52s, and I had noticed that on some of their stuff the rhythm guitar sounded like it was doubled. So I definitely wanted to double the rhythm guitar part on She's Hi-Fi, but we spent, I mean, practically no time on that song.
She got the face of a woman and the brain of a girl. She got the body of a fox and a touch that'll blow up the world. And if she takes you down there, you better beware. She got a whole lot of loving and she don't care. She's high five.
the odd thing about it was, by the time the record was pressed, and then we, three of the four of us, went to school at Mizzou. Dennis Fuller, the bass player, he went to Murray State, and he was like, "Man, I don't think I can, you know, be in the band anymore." But when, you know, we didn't really play my first semester of my freshman year there, but as after the record came out, the radio station KCLU turned the record, and one station did play Lucky Day once, but KCLU, which is a very respected underground station and was respected then and got even more respected through their, when they helped reunite Big Star later, they flipped the record over and they played She's Hi-Fi, and they played it more than they should have probably. But it benefited us so much so that by the spring of my freshman year, late winter, early spring of my freshman year, the song, we sold a bunch of copies of it, and the song got onto party tapes, and then we were in a position to play live by the spring of 82. And Dennis, you know, I called him up and said, "Hey man, are you able to do it?" Or, you know, he's like, "Man, I can't. I just really need to not be in the band. And sorry." And there was never any hard feelings or anything, but we kind of thought, well, we kind of need to play. So I'd met a guy named Bill Goslin who could play guitar, but really wasn't familiar with bass very well. So Bill and I kind of witch-headed to get him up to speed on bass. And then because I could already see that there were going to be some of the new songs I was working on were going to use keyboards too, I felt like we needed to get another guitar in the band that could kind of do lead guitar. And we got Mike Astrakhan, who was a very good friend of ours, a little bit younger. He was still in high school at the time. And so when he could, we would play as a five piece. When he couldn't, we played as a four piece, and we just left, you know, certain songs out or did different arrangements of them. But that's how we did it. And it was, our existence in college was because some airplay that happened on the flip side of the single. She's Hi-Fi got played. I don't know how many times, but it got played enough to make people treat us nice. Lucky Day, as far as I know, got exactly one spin in Columbia, Missouri, which I always thought Lucky Day was by far the better song.
Yeah. But,
you know, but anyway, that's not how it happened. And, so we got notoriety, right off the bat, and it was nice, and it allowed us to play. Got our name out there. The record was, I guess, gave us enough credibility to be an opening act for Fool's Face and the Elvis Brothers, and things like that happened because KCLU played us. If they hadn't played the record, I don't know that anything would have happened. And if they hadn't played the record, we never would have made the album. I still would have been writing those songs, but that album wouldn't have been made that way at that moment. So anyway, that's kind of how I look at it. And I'm grateful to see KCLU disc jockeys forever for being nice to us, because they certainly didn't have to, but they did.
And when you made the record, did you have to put it out yourselves?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
We did it in a slightly different arrangement than the single. But we did it at the same studio, and another friend of mine had kind of said, "Man, you need to talk to my older brother." He was in a garage band, and he, you know, made some recordings back in the late '60s. And he says, that you guys could do this kind of slightly different way and see what you think. And that guy's name was Gary Wilcoxon. And Gary, while I was the one who noticed things like a doubled rhythm guitar through like the first B-52s album, Gary wanted to experiment on either me singing double or Collier doubling his voice. And when Collier doubled his voice at Gary's direction, he sounded very much like Peter Noone. It was really cool, the effect of doubling Matt's voice in the studio had. He was like, man, you guys, if you do this, you can sound like Herman's Hermits. You can do, and he was very instrumental in getting that a much better vocal sound on the album than the vocals were on the single. And then we tried doubling my voice, and he was like, man, you sound just like the Alan Parsons Project. And so I'd already had a slow song that I'd been working on just with the piano riff, and then I finished it off. And so right there in the middle of all those power pop and half punk songs, we had a slower song called 2+2, which I was very conscious of trying to have my voice sound like Eric Wolfson from the Alan Parsons Project.
Why?
Oddly enough, that song got played on a different radio station down in this area in southeastern Missouri, which was odd because no other song of ours sounded like that, but they played it, and we actually have an air track of it being played, and it was kind of weird, but we definitely took the approach that we want to come across with a lot of different kinds of power pop examples, or one song we want it to have a punk feel, one song we want it to sound like it's derived straight from the Monkees, another song we want it to sound like Fool's Face, another song, and whether we were able to translate that, it was still going through us. First, the song Mama Thought You Were a Nice Girl, I wrote that to sound like the Cars, but it ultimately didn't, because instead of the riff being played on the keyboard like I originally wrote it, Mike did it with a fuzzed up guitar, and it had this really rough indie sound. And we did not, the keyboard was still used in the solo and some of the other, and it was there, but I changed the keyboard sound to be more subdued rather than way out front like it would have been had we not tried that, or had we still been a four piece. I would have probably played both the guitar part and the keyboard part. But when Mike played it and put his, crunch on it, we were like, man, that sounds great. And we wanted to, it totally, completely changed the direction of the song. And I think it would have been our slickest song, but when he crunched it up, man, that I thought, wow, this I want to leave it like it is, because this he brought a different sound to it, and I liked we all loved it. As you can tell, this it is a wonderful, all of it is the greatest memories of my life, really. So from those old days, I love it.
And well, it's great to get a perspective from somebody from one of these bands who was actually a big fan of power pop and went into it from that point of view. I haven't really talked to anybody. Everybody else, like I talked to Van Duren and these different guys, and they're all like, yeah, I do a lot more than power pop. Nobody's really into the being pigeonholed like Van, that. But
Van told me himself to be careful.
Yeah.
I mean, Van has sung background on some of my solo stuff. And my solo producer was his producer when he was in Good Question and produced right. Jane and all that. But I could tell you all that, but Van told me the same exact thing. You know, don't get pigeonholed. Be careful. Yeah. Release something that's different just to throw them off, because once you're pigeonholed, you can't get out.
What year did the Mosquitoes form?
Late 1981, I would say. 82, somewhere around there.
And what do you think inspired the kind of music that the Mosquitoes made?
Well, I know what inspired me to do it. It was the name. Everything was, you know, my idea. I had a band before that called Quisp, named after the cereal. You remember the cereal, Quisp?
Right.
With a little Martian on it. It was only three guys. Two of the guys who actually became Mosquitoes after, but they sort of left. The drummer was a filmmaker, and he wanted to get more into that. And Tony just sort of said he was done with music for a while. So I found these other two, this other guy that I knew, and the drummer came back, and we started the Mosquitoes, and then we added the guy Tony back into the group later on. But what inspired the Mosquitoes? Everything from, you know, comic books, cartoons, TV shows, which is where I got the name for the Mosquitoes, from Gilligan's Island.
He's a loser, pay no mind what he says. He's a loser, he's got rocks in both his hairs. He's a loser, he can't win, can't play the show. He's a loser, and you know how much I hate to say I told you so. But I told you so, trouble follows on his tracks.
And heavy British invasion groups like the Mersey Beats and, you know, the Hermits, of course, the Beatles, Dave Clark Five, Dave Berry and the Cruisers, you know, lesser known ones too. But then again, there was Tom Jones, the Partridge Family, Alice Cooper. There's a little bit of all of it in there. I never had any shame of liking stuff that didn't fit that, you know, the cool category.
Were you guys, were you based in New York?
Yes, Long Island. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so how did things progress? Did you try hard to get a record deal and stuff like that?
Yeah, we did. We did. We it was very grassroots the way we did it. We just really we kept getting, back then, to get a good gig was really hard. So I went into the city and got us this gig at this place called RT Fireflies. And that was considered a big gig, and it sort of was a big moment for us. And then we got into a place called the Ritz and the Peppermint Lounge, and so those were the it spots to play if you were in that underground garage thing. Also, this place called the Dive, which was I'm sure if you interviewed the other bands that were around when the Mosquitoes were there, they would all tell you the Dive was one of the key launch pads for all that 80s garage pop music that started.
Mm-hmm. I have two CDs that somebody sent me, it must be 20 years ago, that are all just a lot of live recordings and demos that you did. Like, I remember I love the song Hang, You Don't Give a Hang About Me.
Yeah. You have a live recording of that?
I have two CDs full of stuff, and I know there's multiple versions of that on there. And I don't even know where this stuff came from, but I used to trade.
Neither do I.
I used to trade.
I don't own any of it.
Really?
Nah. When I do stuff, you know, I do it and then I'm done with it. I don't listen to it, and, you know, I don't listen to my own CDs because I don't have any. I don't watch DVDs of myself because I don't have any. I don't look at myself in YouTube because I'm uninterested.
Yeah.
I already know what I do. So that's You Don't Give a Hang About. I wrote that when I was about 15 years old. You Don't Give a Hang About Me. So that I did before the Mosquitoes, and actually before there was even a group called Quisp. I wrote that song and we recorded it on some little, my friend's little two-track recorder. And, you know, then the Mosquitoes did it. That was one of the songs I played to the bass player, Ian, and he said, oh, wow, this is great. And then he got his friend, Eve. They had a band before that called the Fabians. They were more of a punk band. They weren't really a pop band. They really liked that, and there was another song called Quit It. So those became the first two real original songs that the Mosquitoes did. And then I wrote a bunch of, I forgot how many songs I wrote because people keep posting them. So all songs that I forgot.
You were only 17 when I asked you to be my queen. Tell me why you ain't mine. And tell me why I'm sitting here crying. Ah, you don't give a hang about me.
Like 1979, like 1980.
Okay.
1980. I wrote that. I was in high school. First year of high school. So I was at 15, 16 years old.
Okay. So it's got kind of a punky feel, but it's what I would describe as power pop in terms of, you know, there was a lot of bands making similar kind of music right at that time, 1980,
yeah,
that you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, the, you know, the other one was, remember the Rubinus?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I was a little younger than all those, you know, I was younger than those bands, so I definitely listened to those bands, but as I said, I was coming more, I mean, my favorite group was the Monkees, still is, you know, I just loved them, so that's really where I was coming from. Monkees, Partridge Family, and then all the British Invasion stuff as well.
Right.
Anything Beatles or stuff like that.
So by the time you made your EP, did that come out in 1985, I think?
I think it came out in 85, yeah.
Yeah, so that's that's really a late addition to the whole canon of this kind of music.
Yes,
was
definitely.
Was that because it just, you tried to get a record deal for however long, and then finally, did you guys put that out yourself?
No, we didn't put it out ourselves. It was a, I think the guy's name was Bruce Planty, and he had a record store in the city, and he liked the group, and he was starting to put out compilations of local groups, and so we did not put it out ourselves, but it wasn't. You know, it wasn't some big major record label. I think it was called Valhalla Records or something like that. It was, you know, some sort of independent.
So, yeah, what happened was, Arista, you know, they liked the group, and they were coming around, you know, sending a couple of A&R guys. This one guy named Mitchell Cohen, and then I think Mitchell really liked the band, but ultimately Clive Davis liked the songs, but didn't like the, you know, didn't find enough in the band. And truthfully, by that point, the Bangles were already doing what we did better. The Go-Go's were already doing what we did better. So I understand why it didn't all pan out, you know? I mean, there's only room for so much. I never really got the REM thing. I never, everybody was like an REM devotee. I never really got it. It was always a bit anemic for me. And I'm saying that as a fan, not as a guy that should have been me instead of them. Their stuff sounded like B-sides. They never sounded like hit records.
I didn't realize how young you were. So you know, the first couple of years of the band, you were still in high school, huh?
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was very young.
Yeah. So you kind of, you know, you came a little after, you know, the kind of feeding frenzy for that kind of music. Kind of, it seems like almost everybody got a record deal in 79, 80, 81, but.
Correct.
By the time you were getting serious probably about it, that kind of, that whole little fad had kind of already passed you by.
Right.
But, you know, I love the EP. I love the songs. You know, Do You Want to Hurt Me is a great one.
We did a great job on that EP. You know, I felt that I feel the bones are good, but it never really, the energy wasn't captured on there. And I feel like we suffered from what I call 80s-itis. You know, we all knew how to, you know, all of the first Mosquitoes recordings we did, we went in and sang it and played it live. There might have been one or two, like, you know, guitar overdubs just because we didn't have enough guys to play everything at one time. But, you know, by that point, like 1985, everything was much more careful, and we weren't really coming from that. You know, good example, you know, the later Ramones albums, they didn't have the feel of the first five Ramones albums, right? The first five Ramones albums, every song is great, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, it sort of starts getting watered down and overdubs, and it was no longer that sort of a thing. There were bands that do that overdubbing thing way better than we did. So I don't feel it really fit the genre of the music.
Right.
So I was disappointed in the, I think everybody was disappointed in the EP. It was just sort of flat. But, you know, people can see through it that like that kind of music. And, oh, yeah, this, the songs are cool and all that. But, oh, well, thanks for the compliment. I appreciate it. I like that song, too.
Yeah, I can understand what you're saying just about the vibe of the record. It's maybe you were trying, were there outside influences that were...
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, there was a producer, a very nice guy, Toby Lynn. And truthfully, he did his best to get a really great record out of us. And I'll say we fought him on it, and it didn't, it definitely didn't, he wasn't allowed to make us shine.
Mm-hmm.
So, he had his hands tied a bit with some of our own limitations and, you know, preconceived notions of what, how this should be and how that should be. So, yeah, as I said, I think it could have been, it definitely could have been more successful if we had cooperated more with the producer, you know, that sort of a thing. It wasn't the magical experience that some of our earlier recordings had been.
Did you guys just kind of want to play it live in the studio, but he wanted you to record separately?
I don't even know if it's so much that. There were some musical approaches where, you know, like, Do You Want to Hurt Me? Even though I think it predates Stop the World and Melt With You, that's the sort of vibe that that song needed. So, you know, people weren't necessarily embracing that within the band. I was, but other people weren't. So they weren't willing to play more basically like that. You know, it was more, we were still coming from a more nuanced approach to music. And, you know, power pop is not that nuanced, is it?
No. Yeah, right.
No, it's just sort of, you know, eighth notes on the bass and a consistent backbeat on the drums, you know, no no accent notes or grace notes or ghost notes. It was sort of, like I said, neither here nor there, you know, one foot in, one foot out.
So you said 80s-itis. Do you mean, you know, by 1985, your kind of music was kind of out of fashion and there was lots of synthesizers, like you're talking about, I Melt With You is more of like a pop new wave song.
Yeah, but their approach is so appropriate on that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, if you like the music we like, there's no reason you can't like that song. It's got everything. The drums are just great. The guy's vocal is great. That's just a, you know, whereas I hear like Driver 8 and I'm like, okay, that sounds like about as good as the Mosquitoes EP, which wasn't great. But it was, you know, considered genius. You know, Michael Stipe always sounded like he was 80 years old when he sang. He didn't sound like a fresh, you know, fun teen kind of singer. Do you know what I'm talking? Do you know what I'm getting at? It was, It wasn't a good kind of androgyny like David Bowie. It was just anemic. That seems to be my word for the day. But the when I talk about 80s-itis, yeah, I think we were just a little bit careful, like, you know, we weren't experienced with working with a click track, which was perfunctory for an 80s record. You know, you basically everything was a drum machine. So there were all those kind of things that we were up against that we just made. You know, it was an inferior record to what was going on at the time. Just not everybody was on the same page. You know, if you listen to U2, I mean, you could tell they listened to Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois, the producers, right? Everybody was, you know, everybody was given a function and they were allowed to do it and they came out with genius records, right? So, yeah, 80s-itis, I think we were pursuing the sound of what the 80s was supposed to sound like and, you know, our music didn't really translate to that. So that's what I mean by 80s-itis.
I know a secret.
So it sounds like maybe since you couldn't get a record deal, the idea was put out this small record, and maybe that would be your way in, but then you weren't happy with how that turned out.
Well, if people had loved it, the story would have been different, right? We would have been a huge, huge band, but they didn't love it. You know, I mean, some people liked it. Some people really loved it, but not enough people loved it. So,
well, it probably wasn't too easy to get. I don't know did you have any kind of distribution or anything on it?
That I was not very involved with that end of it. It was but a couple of distributors did pick it up. You're right. That was the key word back then, distribution.
Yeah.
It's a distant memory to me. You seem much more connected with that than I am. So, yeah, there were, I think, five or six good distributors that picked it up. You know, I think people did the best with what we gave them.
The Mosquitoes were just a little late to the game, I think. But obviously because of your age, which I didn't even realize how young you guys were. But
well, I was young. They weren't. They were all considerably older than I was. I was the young guy.
I'm not sure how much you know, but I mean, there's like a cult, a power pop cult, that's been, you know, for years now. I mean, I've been collecting it since the '90s. There's a lot of people. You know, you can't buy a Mosquitoes record for less than like $30 now, I don't think.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I had no idea. That's funny.
It's kind of a collectible thing, and I'm sure most people who are really into power pop know the Mosquitoes, you know, and...
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that. I mean, every now and then it comes in waves, like, oh, God, yeah. You know, or playing at a show with, you know, one of the groups that I play with, and somebody will show up with a Mosquitoes album, you know?
Yeah.
So it's pretty shocking to me, but it does happen.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.